His mother told us that Greg hasn't been able to sleep alone since the funeral. The room has three beds, but only two sons. I don't have to ask whose bed I've been sleeping in. Chrissa and I do the bulk of the talking at breakfast. Mrs. Sutter attributes her runny nose to the weather, but I don't think anyone is fooled. Eventually, even Chrissa runs out of small talk, and it's a relief when Greg asks to be excused and the family trickles away from the table, leaving Cor, Chrissa, and me together and alone to clear the dishes and finish up the breakfast tea. It's the first time the three of us have been together in weeks, and it almost feels like a squadron meeting, except today we're talking about the Passy and the Rogue Printing Press and Megara and Annie, getting Chrissa up to speed with all she missed. Her frown deepens the more she learns. What a mess. Right? Cor fumes. I can't believe she did this. Chrissa makes a non-committal noise. Who? She asks. Annie or Megara? Cor glares at her. You all right, Lee? Chrissa asks. I nod, startled from my brooding. I explain the piece I haven't yet told them. Annie wants to plan a widowing in New Pythos. She was asking me if I knew where she could find Drakthanasia. Cor whistles. So that's what she was doing with Garrison? I nod. Do you know where she can find Drakthanasia? Chrissa asks softly. I lift a shoulder, wishing she'd stop looking at me. This isn't something I want to feel guilty about. It's the widowing. I don't owe anyone, not even Annie, a damn thing when it comes to the Red Month. Have you ever seen someone lose their dragon, Chrissa? Chrissa eases backward in her chair just a little, as her face pales. No. We should check on them, Cor says, glancing upward. Chrissa leaves her crutch behind, gripping Cor's arm for support as she favours her injured leg up the stairs of the Sutter fire escape onto their roof. We find the three dragons curled on the slate shingles, lazing in the unexpected warmth, like cats in the sun. The sky remains overcast, but the roofs have dried from yesterday's rainfall, our armour and flame suits piled beside the dragons, glaring in the light. Chrissa kneels to inspect Phaedra's flank. Like Chrissa, she's still on the mend. A shrill noise comes from behind us, and I'm so little expecting it that at first I don't recognise it. It's a child's giggle. Greg and Marina are peeking over the top of the fire escape, curious about the dragons. Cor turns in alarm. I told you two to stay off the roof. Chrissa places a hand on Cor's arm. If you're very careful, she tells the children, I can show you how to pet Phaedra. The children tiptoe forward, and Phaedra perks her head. Cor smiles a bit as he watches them scratch the skyfish under her chin. Then he looks out over the jagged rooftops of the city, toward the manufacturing district, and speaks to me in an undertone. Chrissa, cheerfully instructing the children, doesn't hear. I talked to Val Lazar last night. He said we should storm the vault. Three dragons, that'd be enough. So that's what Megara meant by act soon. Capturing the vault would not only free Megara and the other political prisoners within it, it would also give us control of the People's Paper, the narrative artery of the city. It could serve as a base from which to take on the Inner Palace and the First Protector. It would also be an act of open rebellion. There's more than one way to replace Atreus. With the city starving, the Golds disinterested, Southside's daughter captured, is that what it's time to do?
Annie. A low pass over the city on the way to the vault leaves me in no doubt of the anger in the streets. Word has spread of Megara's arrest, and graffiti the city guard scrubs from walls already reads, "Free Southside's Daughter." Green scarves hang from lampposts and branches. Guards outside granaries stare down the citizens who have congregated in front of them, in the wake of the passy's printing, with nothing else to occupy them on midwinter day. Some, but not all, of the granaries were able to be relocated in the night. Kallipolis feels combustible. I stable Ayla outside the towering, unmarked brick walls of the vault. Inside, I thumb up my mantle to expose the guardian's emblem of the gold and silver circlets entwined on my breast, the bugle of the first rider within them. I'm in full battle armor. Elias Wolf, the Minister of Information, comes down to greet me himself. A revolutionary from Atreus's generation, he sports an aggressively receding hairline, skin so pale it looks luminous, and a smile that does not reach his eyes. Though we know each other from rounds, this is the first time I've come to the vault as an active official.
Miranda Hayne was the one who insisted you be allowed the first stab at this one,
Wolf tells me, as we make our way underground to the level of the temporary holding cells shared by the re-education committee.
Don't see why she thought it was necessary. My methods would have been perfectly effective.
I don't ask what methods he would have used. Megara's cell is level with the city sewers. It smells accordingly. I lift my hand to cover my nose and mouth. She's little more than a silhouette in the darkness. A single torch lights the corridor, and it's far down the row.
Antigone, here to gloat?
I'd like to speak to her in a lit room with chairs and a table. Heated. 10 minutes later, I'm sitting across from Megara in an interrogation room. A guard stands at the edge of the room, hand on the hilt of a saber. At the sight of him, I turn to Wolf. I'll speak to her alone.
Pretend he's not here,
Wolf says, with a dismissive wave at the guard. Wolf leaves the room. The guard remains. So I'm to be watched on orders that outrank mine. From whom? Wolf? Miranda Hayne? General Holmes? Atreus himself? Whether it's to assess my performance or my loyalty is unclear.
Looks like you're on probation, Megara observes.
Her long hair has been cut close to her scalp, clipped in dark chunks like a poorly shorn sheep, for processing. The smell of the sewer lingers on her. Nevertheless, she seems cheerful. I set my helmet on the table between us. I'm going to ask you a few questions. If you don't answer them, others will ask instead. And their methods of interrogation will be harsher. Megara lets out a laugh that cuts off my prepared delivery.
You don't need to tell me what happens in here, Antigone.
My temper flares. My prepared words fall by the wayside.
Then you know that even if you don't talk, even if they don't kill you, they will keep you here until the city forgets your name.
Megara smiles.
Or maybe my arrest will be the spark that sets fire to dry kindling.
The confidence of her assertion fills me with a strange fury.
Why are you so determined to make the city burn?
Megara leans forward.
Why are you so determined to preserve it?
She spreads her open palms. Her chafed wrists raw and exposed under the harsh lamplight.
I'm not the only one they're going to string up. Your turn is coming. Is this really what you want to be strung up for? Firing on commoners, interrogating imprisoned girls, telling widows they can't have a second ration card because of results from a test. Think about it.
The smell of her, of this prison, is all at once too sharp in my nostrils.
I'd rather be strung up for preserving order than destroying it.
Megara's smile spreads like a crack across her face.
Pity,
she says. My way's more fun.
Fun?
I try to imagine the last time I looked at my Guardian medal and felt proud of it. My fists clench on the paper they grip beneath the table.
That's why you do it? Because it's fun?
Megara's face twists.
No, I do it because this country deserves better. I do it because my father bled out in the street during the Southside massacre. I do it because my mother was arrested for daring to speak the truth. This regime has never stopped anyone from speaking the truth about the Triarchy's massacres, I snap.
Megara's answer spews spit.
The Southside massacre wasn't pre-revolutionary. It was post.
I stare at her. Behind her, the guard stands stiff and expressionless as a statue.
I've never heard of it.
Megara lets out a wilting laugh.
Of course you haven't. It wasn't reported. It happened after Atreus disbanded the People's Assembly and instituted you lot. Pro-democratic factions rioted. The city guard was told to put an end to it, and they did. The old-fashioned way.
That's not... I stop short of saying possible, because it is possible. The Ministry of Propaganda has enough control over information that they could have covered up the story completely, discredited accounts, arrested anyone who talked about it.
My mother disappeared after she began to publicize what happened, Megara says. She was let out a year later, a husk of herself, as I assume Richard Tyndale will be when this place is done with him. Like my mother, like me, he disappeared without a trace or a trial because the Re-Education Committee works in unscrutinized secrecy.
Her eyes blaze, looking at me. Like she knows that it's my fault he was taken. And I finally understand her point. Megara isn't concerned by Tyndale's guilt or lack thereof. She's concerned by the ease with which my report made him vanish. It's also possible as to be disquieting. Megara's toothy sneer widens.
This is what happens when you don't have freedom of the press, Annie.
Her use of my nickname, uninvited and dripping condescension, snaps me to my senses. Whatever the truth of Megara's conspiracy theory, it doesn't change the fact that the Passy have leaked state secrets into the hands of our enemy, that the rogue printing press is a national security threat, and that if I don't get its location out of her, the Ministry of Information will find other ways to make her talk. Get this over with, let her go, and then find answers. Do what it takes. It would be a shame to make your family suffer even more. I hold up a piece of paper and pass it across the table to her. She looks down at the list of names, blinks, and then whitens.
You wouldn't.
If this ministry is so happy to cover up its victims, why not add to the list? You said it yourself. I've been firing on civilians with abandon. Why should I make an exception here? Lex, Katerina, Val Lazar?
You wouldn't. You can't.
She's right. I'm not legally able to make good on any of this. But I can tell from her face that I'm the only one who knows that for sure. Do you want to know what it felt like? To watch. Megara's eyes are so round as she stares at me. The whites are visible. I reach behind my head and grip my own hair. I was held like this. The first thing you hear is screaming, but it goes quiet as they begin to suffocate. Megara's launch from her seat is so sudden the chair rocks backward. The guard takes two strides and catches her across the chest as she throws herself across the table at me.
You're an animal! You're a foul, horrible, heartless bitch!
Yes, I am. Megara is sobbing in fury. I wait, but when no further insults are produced, I proceed. Tell me where to find the stolen grain. She sags against the arms of the guard holding her and lifts her head. Her eyes are shining, her teeth bared. In the bellies of the ones who needed it. The moral superiority of her tone makes me want to smash something. The printing press? Foul, Megara breathes. Yes, foul. I feel it. Foul at my own sense of satisfaction as I wait, because I know I have her. And all I had to do was weaponize the memory of watching my family burn. The printing press, Megara inhales, is run by Lo Tiran. For a second, I think I've misheard her. Lo Tiran, the poet. The Kallipolin poet laureate, Lotus's father, whose estate on the Janiculum would be more than large enough to house and hide a printing press and be exempt from most searches conducted by the city guard. Kor, Lee, and now Lotus? The very one, says Megara. The floor vibrates. Megara's guard speaks for the first time.
That's the alarm bells.
His grip has slackened on Megara. Too far underground to hear them, the bells' vibrations pound a rhythm beneath our feet, hammering out the codes that every Kallipolin knows to interpret. Dragons, attack, take shelter. The Pythians have arrived, following the scent of those granary maps all the way to our front steps on Midwinter Day. People are going to die because of this girl's idiocy. As I reach for my helmet, Megara speaks. A serene smile is spreading across her face. Did you know, she says, that there aren't enough bunkers for everyone? I yank the helmet over my head, barely hearing her. What? Megara's blissful look has a wild edge to it. They haven't finished building bunkers. There's a bunker shortage. I was doing a report on it for my Gold Gazette internship right before. But I don't have time for more of Megara's conspiracy theories. I push past her, spill out into the corridor, and take off for Ayla at a run.
Lee. On the Sutter roof, the children have drawn close around Chris's skyfish, trembling with excitement to pet a dragon, and ooing at Phaedra's mother-of-pearl scales shimmering in the light. Mrs. Sutter and Anna have climbed to the top of the fire escape to watch. Anna wraps her arm around her mother, and a smile spreads over Mrs. Sutter's lined face.
Mum, come pet her!
Oh, I don't... But Anna, laughing, pulls her mother forward. Not every day we get three dragons on our roof. That's the feeling I remember from this house, returning to me at last as Kor's family gathers around Chris's skyfish. The ache of remembering, of missing what this felt like. A family, and laughing, and home. I'm remembering it, tasting it, as the distress beacons begin to toll out over the city. Dragons, take shelter, attack. And all at once, the calloused calculations I made this morning feel ghastly, weighing the likelihood that my own actions increased the risk of airstrikes. If there is a fraction of a chance I've endangered my city, my friends, these children, by this mission of justice that is just as much a thinly disguised vendetta against Atreus. Annie's right. The vault, the passy, none of that matters with a hostile fleet on the way. The war that matters is the one in the air. Mrs. Sutter's hands cover her mouth. Greg and Marina have started screaming, their voices shrill over the bells. The dragons lurch to their feet while Anna straightens and looks at Kor in silent conference. The nearest bunker, he says. Anna nods. She takes her mother's hand, ushers her younger siblings down the fire escape, and a moment later they're gone, leaving us alone on the Sutter roof with three restlessly pacing dragons. Chrissa tosses me my flame suit, Kor his, and we begin to suit up.
25. The Midwinter Attack. Annie. Outside the vault, Ayla and I launch to a cacophony of alarm tolls. Low, ribbed stratus clouds spread out over the horizon like shredded sheets. Across the city, our fleet is spilling into the air. I spot Power Sir Eater among the patrician riders ascending from the Janiculum. Lee, Kor, and Chrissa are rising from the Sutter's house in Highmarket. Our sky, filling with the Kallipolan fleet. My spiking fear calms as the world shrinks below Ayla's amber wings. This is where I'm ready for anything. In the saddle. And because the Guardians were able to take their dragons with them on leave, the rest of the Kor is ready too. At the sight of Lotus Sir Eustace, shimmering on an updraft from the Janiculum, I don't let myself question what instinct is telling me to do. Lotus?
Yeah, he calls.
They know! Eustace slows on the updraft. Lotus lifts a glove to his visor.
Thanks, he says.
I return to the circling knot of riders. Chrissa Sir Phaedra, Kor Sir Morana, and Lee Sir Palor, in the centre, awaiting orders for their respective squadrons. I wonder for a fleeting moment about their midwinter at the Sutters, before forcing the thought from my head. It's easier to face the three of them with visors lowered. I want Aurelians and Skyfish forward, heading off over the Farish Plain. We'll keep them over farmland as long as we can. Stormscourge Squadron in reserve over the city. As Chrissa and Kor peel off with their respective squadrons, Lee Sir Palor joins Ayla's side.
Do you need a wing rider? He asks.
I lift my visor to look at him. The city below, the clouds above, the horizon a line my eyes are fixed on, and my heart pounding in time with Ayla's. This is the place where everything else between me and Lee Sir Palor is put aside. If Lee's ready to fight, I'm ready to have him. But I have terms.
I want Ixion.
Lee's visor is up. His lip lifts in something like a smile.
Then I'll take Griff.
I wonder if he's waiting for me to say, go gentle on him, just like I did last time when all my plans of mercy backfired. I don't. Griff can take care of himself. I lower my visor. Lee Sir Palor drifts to second wing rider position above and behind me, leaving me to lead. One thing I didn't account for, the wind is in the Pythian's favour. It will take our fleet twice the strength to hold them against winds that blow south. The sun is low on the horizon, firing the edges of the clouds with gold. And as we flood the skies over the Farish Plain, I strain my gaze north. Ayla's keen eyes spot them first. She tenses, and I feel her excitement like fire as I follow her gaze. The full Pythian fleet skims from cloud to cloud like skipping stones. Still dwarfed on the horizon, but as they see us, they dive, burrowing into the coils of stratus. I sound the bugle to mount higher. We'll take the height advantage.
Horns when they breach!
The order echoes as it relays down the Skyfish and Aurelian lines. We mount as high as the winter cold allows us. The rolling plains of the lowlands, barren in winter and scudded with drifts of snow, lie below us, broken here and there by toy-sized villages. Their tolling alarm bells echo distantly and pulse on the wind in my ears. I feel the cold of the higher altitude seeping through my flame suit, biting my fingers. And breath begins to fog the edges of my visor. And in the break between two great clouds, the Pythians re-emerge below us. Wings glowing in the low light, long skyfish tails trailing, great black storm scourge wings blotting out the ground below. I motion with my fist, and the Kallipolan fleet bears down on them, firing as they go. It takes me only an instant to pick out the wing riders we look for. Ixion Sonita, with Griff Sir Sparker on his wing. It feels like we're beating against the wall of the air itself to get to him, dodging through engaging pairs on either side of us, determined to engage him before he can come any closer to my city. We hurtle toward Ixion and ram him off course, into a cloud bank, whiteness surrounding me. And in my peripheral vision, Lee goes for Griff.
Lee. The thing I never understood when our fleet returned from New Pythos was how Annie could have been held off by anyone. I've spent a lifetime sparring with her, and I know that when Antigone Sur-Ela wants to get past you, she can. The fact that she was held off by a rider reported to be muzzled made it all the stranger. But when Palor and I come up against Griff Garrison and his storm scourge above the Ferrish Plain, I finally understand. They are a brick wall. They ride fearless of dragonfire, of talons, of fangs, as if that muzzle makes their desperation deadlier. The storm scourge fights like a feral dog with the weight of a bear. And the wind's in their favor. Every time Palor fires, they dodge. And every time they charge, we're rammed back, south, toward the city. Fire is our first and best weapon. But while tussling with Griff and his storm scourge, it becomes about talon and fang as Palor struggles over and over again to free himself. An opening over the storm scourge's wing. We fire. Griff grunts in pain. His storm scourge howls. An edge of blackness crowds my vision, and I toss my head to clear it. Not now. Not the bloody flame shot now. But I can't think. And Palor's wing is crushed to his side, and we are losing altitude. Hurtling downward through the clouds, I realize I no longer know where we are, what lies below, and the stratus glows a deep red in the setting sun. Lost in clouds, the sky court of Pytho's keep rises to meet us out of nowhere. The two dragons slam against the flagstones. Pain explodes down the leg crushed under Palor. He feels it and struggles to right himself, to alleviate the weight, and my sluggish fingers fumble to cut the bootstraps, binding me to the stirrups. The shadow of a great black storm scourge falls across us. Now I'm exposed, pinned, about to be gnawed alive by Ixion's bulldog squire. A knife is inserted into my bootstrap and slices. Palor groans and shifts his weight while curling his wings inward, relieving the pain in my leg. The knife again, cutting. An armored arm, thick and blackened with soot, hooks across my chest and heaves. Out of the saddle, onto the ground beside Palor, and across the flagstones to the shelter of the nearest crumbling arch. Griff Garrison has pulled me off my dragon. We are alone atop the cast of Pytho's keep, shrouded in mist, under the eaves of a ruined column of the old sky court. He's removed his helmet, revealing curling hair and shockingly blue eyes set in a tan face. His armor, Pythian white stained with ash, bears no house sigil. He glances out, squinting at the sky around us. We are fully enveloped by the clouds and see only the occasional glow of dragonfire through the mist, accompanied by distant cries and horn blasts. Garrison expels a breath through pursed lips and crouches in front of me. Palor's head swings round. He growls, hackles raising, wings rising and tail stiffening. A few yards away, an answering growl, much deeper and louder, answers. Garrison's Storm Scourge, sensing a threat to its rider. For the first time, I get a good look at its muzzle. The thing's even more ghastly up close, crowding up around his horns, constricting his jaw. "I'm not going to hurt him," Garrison tells Palor. He adds over his shoulder, "And you, calm down." The Storm Scourge's growling subsides. Garrison begins unfastening the armor on my crushed leg. Deftly, quickly, as if he's used to taking armor off other people. "You're Leo, the one who killed Julia." His dragon tongue is almost accentless, like household staff who's been raised in service. His address, seemingly automatic, is that of a servant speaking to a lord. His fingers pull free one plate, then another, presses a thumb against my knee, searching for a reaction. When he finds it, he reaches for the arm guard punctured along my shoulder. His fingers come away wet and red. He pushes aside my fumbling fingers impatiently, peels back the neck of my flame suit, and applies pressure. I hear myself do the automatic thing in return, the informal "you." "You knew her?" His face darkens. I knew her. Griff uses a slightly different word for "knew," with an edge of fury that makes the hair on the back of my neck rise. He scrapes his fingers through dark curls and his whole face scrunches. He wipes carefully, applies pressure again. And then he murmurs, so quietly I wouldn't hear it were he not crouched by my ear, "I'm glad you killed her." There's no way Griff can know that this choice is the thing that has haunted me for months. That this was the reason my vision blackened and we fell. The fear that in making a horrible choice, I also made the wrong one. He can't know the weight his words shift. Of course he's glad she's dead. Julia spoke about ideals she found absurd and serfs we owned. I had seen enough of where that got my father to balk, even if for Julia and me it remained a difference in principle. It's more than a matter of principle for Griff Garrison. Of course, of course. Garrison's voice remains low as it gains intensity. "I'm going to do the rest of them. Ixion, Rhode, all of them. With Drachthanasia first for the dragons. Antigone's getting me some." Listening to Garrison as he serves me so competently with the ease born of years of training to be useful to a lord, I feel my heart constrict. Though I backed away from Annie in horror at the mention of Drachthanasia, I hear it differently now. I hear Griff's words as the desperate hope of a people who have suffered for generation upon generation at the hands of the Dragonborn. And then the next thing he says makes sorrow bloom in my chest. "I'm going to spare Dilo Surgifera. He's not like them. More like you." He's refastening my flame suit, his eyes fixed on it. Dilo, I remember, as unfailingly kind, unusually thoughtful, and reluctant in the face of violence. When the others teased Laertes for being passed over, he stopped them. I straighten where I sit, fighting the round of dizziness that accompanies the sudden motion, the pain that redoubles in my shoulder. It's suddenly the most important thing in the world that Garrison understand what I'm about to say. "Griff, you will be unleashing something you can't control. It may not be possible to choose. Even Atreus admits that Palaestay got out of hand. You need to be prepared for that." Garrison shakes his head. His hands, red with my blood, turn to fists. He reaches behind him, fingers clicking to his great Storm Scourge, who comes to his side and crouches to mounting height. I'll control it. There's an edge to his voice that brooks no arguing. And is there a point in making him doubt himself now? This is what he has to do. Just as I had to kill Julia. Garrison has one boot in the stirrup, about to hoist himself onto his dragon, when he turns back to me. Does Antigone have the poison yet? Will she have it by our next meeting? Exhaustion hits me in a wave. A toll from blood loss, maybe, or from the realization of what is needed. I slide to my feet, bracing my back against the brick. When do you meet next? At the end of the week, in the new year. I'll make sure she does.
Annie, until I faced Ixion today, I've never known what it is to hate someone with such a rage that I wish they could be wiped from the face of the earth. To wish they were incinerated. This is the bastard who took Duck from me. I'm not aware of the moment when my fury becomes Ayla's, when we cease to be two and become one. I'm aware only of a desire bigger than me, like a fire burning through my body, to consume this boy and let him burn. Ixion Cernita's flight pattern is erratic, but not so much that we can't anticipate them, and for every attempt they make to shake us, we only follow tighter. Lost in a cloud's seamless white, there is nothing but Ixion and Nita and Ayla and me. Nita slams against Ayla and doesn't let go. Ayla struggles to free herself, but he's too big, his claws piercing deep and holding fast. She begins to bite instead. I know the name of Ixion's dragon through Griff, saw the scars of Nita's fangs along Griff's arms, and now Ayla gnashes her own fangs against Nita with equal vengeance. What's the matter, Antigone? Does your little peasant dragon have trouble sparking? We ignore him. We'll save our fire for when we need it. It's what we're good at. And in the meantime, we'll shred them with our teeth. I cling to Ayla's saddle in the whiteness, hardly knowing when we're sideways, upside down, sideways again as she struggles to free herself from Nita and we rise and fall with their erratically beating wings. But then, as suddenly as it began, the cloud ends. The world fills in around us, and I realize that in our mad tussle, we've allowed ourselves to be pushed south. We're no longer over the Ferrish Plain. The city spreads directly below us. And so does the aerial battle. The other sparring riders have been blown back just as I was. The cannons on Pytho's keep are too shrouded in fog to provide coverage, but the ones on the Aurelian walls pop distantly below. Above them, sandwiched between cannon and dragonfire, my riders tangle with Ixion's like so many scrabbling birds. Kor's reserve of storm scourges are deploying to assist Chryssa with her skyfish and Aurelians. Wing riders are trading off as their fire is depleted, weaving in and out of our cannon's clumsy ranges. But my task is to occupy Ixion. I can feel every puncture of Nita's talons and fangs along Ayla's wings, her every screech making me grit my teeth as I feel her pain. But she exchanges bite for bite, waiting him out until he tires enough for us to kick free. But Nita is larger, and he pries an opening first. His long neck twists around Ayla's shoulder, and his face peers over it at me. I stare into the Storm Scourge's narrowing black eyes, framed with that strange silver crest. I'm wide open, completely exposed, and at point-blank range. Nita's fangs are bared as he inhales. I duck, yanking the reins. Ayla jerks us sideways into a flick roll, throwing Nita off balance. The shot courses wide, but it grazes my helmet and side with its heat. For a moment, the pain of it dizzies me. And then I realize what was wrong. It hurt, but not enough. That blast wasn't fire. It was ash. Ixion kicks Nita's flank, and with our dragons locked together, the force of that kick reverberates through Ayla and me too. Come on! The Storm Scourge hacks a cough, and this time flames do erupt. But they're weak, barely enough to harm me. Ixion's goad from minutes ago echoes in my ears. What's the matter, Antigone? Does your little peasant dragon have trouble sparking? And I realize that the one time I've ever seen Ixion Sonita go in for the kill, it wasn't with fire at all. It was with fangs, biting through Duck's girth. Ayla isn't the one who has trouble sparking. Nita does. How has Griff never mentioned this before? Because Griff might not even have noticed. In training and in tournaments, sparked dragons spar doused. Ayla can smell Nita's fear. I can smell it. And we can spark just fine. Ayla twists free, finally, of Nita's talons, launches from his grasp, and beats the air to right herself. She inhales. Ixion lets out a rasping laugh. Look down. I spare a glance and freeze. Calypolis is on fire. Fires are sprouting in the manufacturing district. Southside, Scholar's Row. The Pythians broke our line. Even now, their muzzled riders hold off mine, providing coverage while their storm scourges descend. Calypolin riders sound distress calls on their horns, tinnily muffled this high above. But the reserves are already engaged, with no more to come. Cannons are barraging from the Aurelian walls, but for every Pythian they deter, another descends. I held off Ixion, but that wasn't enough. Not all of the granary sites they targeted still contain grain. Much of it was moved in the night. But the fires are spreading, catching on neighboring thatch and wooden frames, catching on homes. Even if grain was saved, lives won't be. And in my frozen moment of hesitation, I lose my opening. Griff Sir Sparker fills our vision, wings fanning out on either side like great black sails, protecting Ixion Sonita from our blast. They must have broken free of Lee. Where were you? Ixion shouts. Griff's voice comes out muffled. Spending quality time with the traitor, my lord. Ayla rams Sparker's side with a squawk of indignation. On the dunes, they're friendly. But Sparker doesn't budge. He forms a wall between us and Nita that Ayla works against with rising frustration. You finish him? Ixion asks. No, but I left him a little the uglier for you, sire. So Lee is decommissioned. Wounded? Ixion barks a laugh. He lifts the bugle to his lips and sounds it. Below us, the Pythian fleet begins to disengage. Below them, the fires spread. You know why I'm calling my riders off, Antigone? He calls. When I make my return along the triumphal way, I want Calypolins to be alive to kneel for it. My vision is blurring behind my visor, fogging as my eyes grow wet with fury. I'll kill you! I've never said that before. Not when Leon Stormscourge torched my home with my family in it. Not when bullies held me down. Not when Ayla rose to goads in the arena. I've never said it before. But this one time I say it, it's a vow. Griff stiffens in the saddle, and Sparker's tent-like wings falter. Ixion only laughs.
Looks like your peasants need you, he says. Good luck feeding them.
He yanks on Nita's reins, then sounds his bugle again. His fleet is rising now, burrowing into the cloud cover one by one and vanishing. Ixion and Griff last of all.
Until next time, Griff mutters.
He's gone before I realize he means it as a coded reminder. Ayla and I are left looking down over the blaze sites spreading in my city like cancers. Lisa Palor finds us moments later, emerging from the cloud cover with one shoulder hunched and Palor rasping for breath. He shoves up his visor with a glance after the retreating Pythian fleet, and then looks back at me. Streaks of sweat run down his soot-covered face, and his armor is stained on the shoulder with what might be blood. But he sits secure enough in the saddle. I let out a hitching breath. Lee, at least, is fine. Or managing for now.
Orders, Commander, he calls.
I'm too shaken to dwell on the strangeness of Lee Sir Palor, Leon's son, asking me for orders. But the sound of my title brings me to my senses. Commander. As my wing rider, as my Alternus, he's offering to defend the city while I take a squadron into those clouds after Ixion. And so badly do I want it, that for a moment Ayla stirs beneath me at the thought of Ixion dead. But I have a responsibility for more than my own vendetta. Souls are dying below. Pursuing the Pythians would take riders from a response team that the blaze sites now need, and pursuing them into clouds like these would be a fool's errand. I look from the seamless stratus above to the city burning below and make the choice. Ayla strains to pursue, but I tighten my grip on the reins, turning us back to Earth. Another day. Another day we'll finish him.
Form a perimeter,
I tell Lee, and sound the summons to riders for extraction.
Griff. The burns left by Leo Stormscourge's dragon begin to wear me down as we make our way back to New Pythos. That little white Aurelian might not look like much, but his fire packs a punch. As we descend into Sailor's Folly and pass the first clan casts, I have a moment of wondering if the pain has made me hallucinate. A dragon the size of a whale, with wings like sails, is perched on Thornrow's cast. A Goliathan, from Basilia. Her wings, when they beat the air, create their own winds. I've only ever seen them in tapestries. Along the ramparts, alongside the banners of the Great Lord and the Triarchy, the crest of the Basilean whale fin flutters. Sparker lands heavily, clumsy with exhaustion, on the citadel balustrades, and I slice my bootstraps with fumbling fingers. It takes me a moment to notice the attendants flurrying around us. One of them tells Ixion, "She's here." And then trumpets begin to sound, and all around us, Dragonborn, whom I've never seen make obeisance in their life, drop to their knees. Stiffly, I lower to mine. I hear her voice from the other side of Sparker's drooping wings, a guttural accent on her dragon tongue, unlike any I've ever heard before.
"Welcome back, Lord Ixion."
Freyda. "Your Highness, what a pleasant surprise. You anticipated my invitation."
"I thought it might be time. And this must be one of these squires that I've heard so much about."
I keep my eyes trained on the ground, but on my peripheral vision, a floor-length fur mantle, snow-white, flows across the stones and stops in front of me and Sparker. His tail trailing the ground, his chest heaving, Sparker aches for his lair so badly I can feel it.
"Look at me, Serf."
I lift my head a fraction, Freda has fair skin, delicate features, silken brown hair pulled into a long braid down her back. She is perhaps a year or two older than Ixion and I, and her round face conveys a compassion, her heavy-lashed eyes a curiosity that's at odds with her cool tone. Behind her, the Goliathan's wings blot the horizon.
In my country, she says, slaves would never be allowed to ride a dragon.
26. Flamefall. Annie. The one and only time our fleet ever performed extractions before today, Starved Rock, this fall, it was only a handful of villagers from a sparsely populated island. I was not authorized to go. Lee made the call that my history, the fact that the last time I saw a blaze site I was a child being forced to watch, made me unfit to perform an extraction. But today, I have no superior officer to exempt me from duty. Blaze site response teams are already establishing a perimeter to contain the fires. Scholar's Row's wide avenues and stone masonry are the least damaged. The fire's petering out. Highmarket already has hoses pumping water from the nearest banks of the Fir. But the manufacturing district's fire has spread to Cheapside. And Cheapside, with its thatched roofs and narrow streets, is ablaze. Looking down on this city from above, I watch the pattern of the fires imitate the maps of poverty I've seen on rounds in the ministry for as long as I can remember. Poor neighborhoods, class iron neighborhoods, in most vivid red. As I circle closer, I realize that the feeling in my stomach, the heaving, is nausea. I force the rising memories from my head. Around me, riders are pairing off to begin extractions. Lee joins Corps Sir Morana on the far side of Highmarket. Lotus and Rock are already taking turns diving in and out of the blaze in the manufacturing district. Power Sir Eater comes to my wing, the great breadth of his Storm Scourge's wingspan blocking sight of the fires over Cheapside.
"You could sit this one out," he says.
At his suggestion, my flagging resolve hardens. To hell with their pity.
Spot for me!
Without another look at him, I dive. Ayla and I descend into a Cheapside two-story residential unit whose roof is lost to flames. We land on the shuddering second floor. The heat is all engulfing, and the flames fill my vision. For a moment, a single thought overwhelms me as I cling to Ayla's back and struggle to breathe. This is how they died. No, I am not that child today. Today, I'm the one with the dragon, and I'll be using it to get the victims out. I dismount and force a breath into my bugle, sounding through the smoke. All I can hear is crackling in answer. But then Ayla cocks her head, her eyes focusing, and I follow her gaze. Or perhaps it is with her vision that I see now, because the thoughts of my father and brothers and sisters have flooded into a spillover so strong, I am one with her. I follow her gaze, stumbling through the fire, and find the huddled figures in the corner of the shaking floor. They're unconscious. I lift the child into my arms, hoist the woman's arm over my shoulder, and heave. Ayla's silhouette bursts through the flames, and she lowers onto her belly for me to drape the woman over her back. I clamber on, clutching the child and clinging lopsidedly to Ayla's saddle, then hold us steady as she kicks with full force from the ground, her wings beating the air to lift her burden. We land on the street outside the perimeter of the flames, where blaze site response teams wait with pumps and water and medics. I surrender the woman and child into the waiting arms of the medics, and then kick back off into the air without waiting to hear if they are alive or dead. I'll do this without looking back, or I won't be able to do it at all. Back above the blaze site, Power shouts.
You all right?
I'm fine. Go. I circle with Ayla above the blaze site while he and Ita go in, and by the time it's my turn again, the heat of the fire has dried my tears. We continue, in and out of the burning buildings, as the sun and the fires go down.
Annie, Power finally says, let's take a break.
We need to keep looking.
The fires are down, they're opening the bunkers. You need to hydrate.
We land on the riverbank, choked with ash. In this part of the city, downriver from the manufacturing district, it's clogged with waste even on a good day. Its muddy banks deserted. I pull off my helmet and splash soot-blackened water over my face. Behind us, the smouldering blaze site smokes into the dusk sky. I had planned, after this intermission, to get back into the air immediately. But now that I'm on the ground, I find my knees giving out beneath me. I sink to a seat in the mud, place my head between my knees, and begin to sob. Here. Power has pressed his mostly empty canteen into my hand, and I drain it before thinking to protest. But I can't stop crying.
Annie, look at me.
His glove grips my shoulder, so tightly that I feel its weight.
We just saved lives.
I drag my palms one after another across my face. He's right. I wasn't the stick today. I wasn't firing on protesters or denying ration cards to those who wanted them. I was protecting my people. Just like I believed as a child when I took those vows that I would. The thought feels like a cool breeze, fresh as the sea, blowing through my heart and my head and my soul. And though perhaps it shouldn't, it helps prepare me for what comes next. Rock, landing in front of us on his storm scourge, his visor lifted, his face ashen.
Annie, he says. The bunkers.
And then his voice breaks.
Lee, we don't understand at first when we find it. Such has been my singularity of purpose since parting with Griff on Pytho's keep, that even as Kor and I stand in the middle of the scene, looking around us at the evidence, I don't see it for what it is. We're in the ruins of Highmarket, in the heart of its dying blaze site, in a clearing at the center of which is a sunken entrance to an underground compound that ventilates through slats in the cobblestones. A public bunker. And around us is a sea of motionless black ash that forms, here and there, shapes barely recognizable as bodies. Bodies everywhere. Through the saturated filter of my visor, I can smell charred flesh. Kor has begun to shake so badly that his legs wobble. Morana, perched with Palor on a surviving mainframe on the edge of the flare, begins to snort and kick at her perch.
Why aren't they?
Why aren't they safe, alive, inside this bunker? I push past him and climb down the sloping entrance to the closed wrought iron door. I hammer on it, the metal ringing like a drum.
Extraction! Open up!
There's silence on the other side. Behind me, Kor lets out a hissing breath.
Lee, they're class irons.
I spin around. What?
The dead. They all have iron wristbands.
The metal door creaks, a bolt turning inside, and I turn back to it as it opens. I find myself face to face with several members of the city guard. Behind them, civilians, faces hidden in shadow. Someone inside whispers, "That's Lee Sorpalor." Instead of stepping aside to make way for their exit, I push between the guards and step into the darkness. "Show me your wristbands, everyone." A glint of wrists raised, all glowing enough in the dim light for me to know. Gold, bronze, and, in the case of the city guard, silver. The bunker's not close to full. "Get out," I tell the civilians. They begin to trickle past. One of them brushes fingers on my armor, and I cast a brief glance at her before realizing that I know her. Mrs. Sutter, Cor's mother. I was in her house this morning. It's nearby, only a few blocks away. She must have sheltered here with her family, her husband and Greg on one side, Marina on the other. A bronze family safe from the fire. But then I realize Anna, who tested iron, is not with them. Mrs. Sutter's eyes are wild and bloodshot as her gaze flits from me to the guards. Mr. Sutter, beside her, is slack-jawed, his gaze unseeing as he holds Greg's hand. "Bring us justice, Lee," Mrs. Sutter whispers. The Sutter family passes, and I look back at the Silvers whose job it was to oversee this bunker, members of the High Market garrison of the City Guard, who have been standing at attention since I've arrived, fists raised in the revolutionary salute, hands on the hilts of their sabers. It's good Palor is outside, not with me, because if my fury were able to spill into him in this moment, these soldiers would be dead. "Which of you is in charge?" One of them steps forward, only a few years older than me, a spotty mustache unshaven. "Sir, why didn't you let those irons into this bunker?" But before he can answer, howling cuts the air. Through the open door from the square outside. Once it begins, it doesn't stop. Low, anguished, and unmistakable. Because I held that same person while he made that same noise only weeks ago. Cor, crying his sister's name like he wants the sky to crack open and answer him. Anna. The guard swallows, sweat beading on his pimply forehead. His fingers clutch the hilt of his saber. "We were following orders."
Annie. On the choked riverbank, standing in the mud beside Power, Rock presses an iron wristband into my palm. Ash peels from it in flakes. He makes his report, weeping as his thick hands cover his face, pulling at fair hair. Megara was right about the bunkers. Not enough had yet been completed to meet the needs of the city's population. The Kallipolin Ministry dealt with this shortage in its signature way, prioritizing certain lives over others, based on their worth to the state. In other words, based on their metals test. The way this looked seems to have varied depending on the neighborhood, the bunker, the particular garrison in charge of enforcing. In the more affluent neighborhoods, like Scholar's Row and the Janiculum Hill, servants were allowed into the bunkers last if they were allowed in at all. In middle-class neighborhoods like Highmarket and Southside, citizens were asked to form separate queues based on their wristband and admitted in order of priority. In the poorest neighborhoods, Cheapside and the manufacturing district, the greatest problem was that there weren't enough bunkers in the first place. The segregated queues in the middle neighborhoods were where things turned ugliest. Irons and even bronzes were turned aside, forced to wait while golds were let in as the fires began to rain down, and sometimes, if the soldiers panicked, they were not let in at all. In the most horrific cases, bunkers were found with room to spare and lower-class metals dead outside.
The guard were asking to see wristbands,
Rock says, his Highland brogue returning as he loses control.
And they're all trained to show them, from rationing distribution, so of course they just...
I stare down at the iron wristband in my palm.
I don't know why I had to take it. I just kept thinking I wanted evidence.
I hear what he isn't saying, because I'm thinking it too. Evidence. In case this regime tries to hide these atrocities. As we know, it hides and manipulates information as a matter of course. We've known it for as long as we've done rounds with the Ministry of Propaganda, but only understood the full repercussions today. When Megara told me about a massacre I'd never heard of, committed by the regime I serve. And now this. Where are the others? Rock wipes his eyes, streaking his face with still more ash.
Lotus went with Kor. He said they were going to take the vault. They're working with the Passiani. Lee too, I think.
I know. But I no longer care. I've been lost in details. Threads of merit versus fault. Of whether the Passi are heroes or terrorists for stealing grain and leaking secrets. But none of that matters compared with this. In the end, on the most fundamental point, the Passi are right. This is the crime that matters. We are all equally deserving. How is it only now, faced with this, that I understand?
Lee. Kor, his mother, his father, and his brother and sister are huddled together outside the bunker, gathered around a figure that Mr. Sutter leans over to embrace, and Mrs. Sutter turns her younger children's faces from. Kor holds himself, rocking back and forward as he weeps. It feels obscene to approach them in this grief. But when I touch Kor's shoulder, he rises to his feet. His blotched face contorts, the words coming out in gulps. They separated them. Those bastards. They told her to wait. I seize his shoulders. There are two ways to survive this kind of anguish, with waiting or with action. And if I guess right,